We would like to send out a special thanks to Manly Bands for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Manly Bands helps men find wedding bands that fit their personality and their budget with unique and stylish designs. To get 20% off your Manly Band for a limited time and get a free silicone ring, go to manlybands.com/cold. We would also like to send out a special thanks to Ready Slim for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Ready Slim focuses on providing the highest quality detox and keto products fit for any busy lifestyle. To save 25% on your first order of Ready Slim's 28-day detox tea kit for a limited time and get a free collapsible water bottle, go to readyslim.com/cold. Thank you and enjoy the show. October 28th, 1991. Wheeling, Illinois. A 911 dispatcher receives an anonymous call from a payphone by a man asking for medical attention for a woman. When paramedics arrive at the address the caller provides, they discover the unconscious body of 27-year-old Jamie Santos on her bedroom floor. Jamie dies before she arrives at the hospital, and it turns out she has been suffocated with a pillow. There is ambiguity about whether the caller was Jamie's killer or an innocent bystander who found her body, but he cannot be identified, and Jamie's murder is never solved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a pair of cold cases which were featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the 1991 murders of Jamie Santos and Rebecca Young. I've received requests to cover each of these cases, and I thought it would be a good idea to feature both of them on the same episode since they contain a number of similarities. The crimes took place 30 years ago within 6 months of each other, and while it's very unlikely there's any connection between them, they both center around an anonymous phone call to 911. In the Jamie Santos case, the victim was fatally smothered with a pillow inside her home, and she wound up being discovered after an unidentified male called 911, but he hung up before they could determine his identity. For this reason, it's been suspected that the caller may have been Jamie's killer making a last-ditch effort to get her proper medical attention before she died. In the Rebecca Young case, the 911 caller was a Spanish-speaking man who claimed he had witnessed the brutal murder of a woman near a remote sugarcane field and provided the location of her body. Well, sure enough, his tip panned out, as Rebecca was found at the spot, but even though investigators found a promising suspect, they lacked the evidence to make an arrest. This is why they were hoping the 911 caller would come forward and share his first-hand eyewitness account, but he never did, and both these cases are still unsolved 3 decades later. Anyway, I'll start off this episode by exploring Jamie's case before I provide my theories and analysis, and then I'll move on to Rebecca's story. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the murder of Jamie Santos. Our story begins in 1991 in Wheeling, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago located around 23 miles northwest of the downtown area. Our central figure is 27-year-old Jamie Santos, who lives alone in a rented townhouse and makes her living as an exotic dancer. At 11:31 a.m. on the morning of Monday, October the 28th, a 911 operator received a call from an unidentified man who said they needed to send an ambulance to 1765 Stonehenge Court in Wheeling because a woman there was not breathing and turning blue. The call had come into fire and emergency services in Buffalo Grove, another suburb of Chicago which is adjacent to Wheeling, so the operator transferred the call to Wheeling's emergency medical services. After the next operator got on the line, the caller repeated what he said and provided the same address. The operator then asked the man where he was calling from, and he said it was a public phone. But after she said, quote, "When were you at that house, sir?" he replied, "Bye," and abruptly hung up. 4 minutes later, paramedics arrived at 1765 Stonehenge Court, which turned out to be Jamie Santos's address. When they entered the bedroom, they discovered Jamie's body on the floor. She was dressed only in a nightshirt and underwear and had a pillow behind her head. At this point, Jamie was unconscious and completely unresponsive, so she was taken out of the house and rushed to a hospital, but died before she arrived. An autopsy would reveal that Jamie's exact cause of death was suffocation, as someone had used the pillow found behind her head to smother her. When police examined the townhouse, they found no signs of forced entry, as the front door had been closed when paramedics arrived, but not locked. There were also very few signs of struggle, aside from a few bruises on Jamie's chin and neck, but she was not sexually assaulted, and there were no drugs in her system. While investigators found some unidentified fingerprints at the residence, they were unable to match them to anyone, so they put most of their focus on the anonymous 911 caller. Here is the original audio of the call.
911, Max. Yeah. Can an ambulance or police or someone to 1765 Stonehenge Court in Wheeling immediately? There's a young woman in there who's not breathing. She's turning blue.
All right, hold on just a minute, all right? Because this is Buffalo Grove. Just a minute. Hold on just a minute, okay? I'm going to try and transfer you. Hold on a second. Hello?
Yeah.
Hold on just a minute.
No, there's no time.
Wheeling Police, Kelly.
Yeah, that's the one to 1765 Stonehenge Court in Wheeling. Immediately, there's a young woman there who's not breathing. She's turning blue.
1765 Stonehenge?
Stonehenge. Head's like a bush.
Okay, in Wheeling?
Yeah.
What phone are we calling from?
I don't know. It's public phone.
Wheeling, can you hear me? This is Buffalo Grove 911.
Yeah, I can barely hear you.
All right. He's calling from an address in Buffalo Grove.
Yeah.
When were you at that house, sir?
Bye.
Sir?
It turned out the call had taken place at a payphone outside a liquor store at the Grove Court Mall, which was located a half block away from Jamie's home. Even though she lived in Wheeling, the phone was technically located in the adjacent suburb of Buffalo Grove, which is why the call came into their fire and emergency services. When the caller provided Jamie's address to the operator, he had to correct her and confirm that she did not live on Stonehenge Drive, but Stonehenge Drive with a D. This made investigators suspect that he was familiar with the area, but they could not be 100% certain if he was the killer. According to the official Wheeling Police Department press release, quote, "It's unclear if the caller is connected to the murder or if he simply came across a terrible crime." Indeed, investigators did acknowledge the possibility that the caller may have been an innocent bystander who saw something or discovered Jamie's body, but decided to remain anonymous when he phoned for help because he feared he might be accused of being the killer. Within days of Jamie's murder, audio from the 911 call was released publicly, and while a number of people came forward who believed they recognized the man's voice, these leads never panned out, and none of Jamie's friends or family members could figure out who he was either. In December of that year, police publicly released a surveillance video taken by a security camera inside the liquor store located next to the payphone, as it showed a man walking inside there and making a purchase only 2 minutes after the 911 call took place. However, the man in the video soon recognized himself and voluntarily went to the police, and he was eventually ruled out as being the caller or having any involvement in the murder. Investigators attempted to backtrack Jamie's movements prior to her death and figure out if the crime had any connection to her work as an exotic dancer. She had previously worked as a topless waitress and a showgirl at bars, but decided to transition into dancing at exclusive private events, such as bachelor parties. These gigs would be booked through various agencies Jamie worked with, and often allowed her to pull in more than $1,000 per week. The night before the murder, Jamie canceled some bookings she had made after claiming she was feeling ill. The last time she was confirmed to be alive was when she spoke to a friend of hers on the phone and said she had rented out some videos and was planning to spend the night at home. As far as anyone knew, Jamie had no plans to invite anyone else over. When Jamie's family first learned about her decision to perform exotic dancing at private parties, they became concerned about her potential safety, but Jamie assured them that she had a driver or bodyguard accompanying her at all times, and she could always leave these parties whenever she wanted if the situation got out of hand. She also performed under a stage name, Sasha, and made it a rule that she would never date any of her customers or give her real name or phone number to anyone she met at one of these parties. Jamie had recently dated a few men, including a man from Virginia whom she met during a vacation to Jamaica, and a local musician. According to the owner of one of her booking agencies, Jamie's relationship with the musician was becoming pretty close, and she was considering the possibility of moving to California with him, though they had apparently been fighting in the weeks prior to her death. In spite of this, neither the musician nor the man from Virginia were considered to be suspects in Jamie's death. Since Jamie was found wearing her nightshirt and was known for sleeping in until noon, it was theorized that someone showed up at her residence on the morning of the crime. It could have been a man who was infatuated with Jamie, but when she resisted his advances, things turned violent and led to him smothering her to death with a pillow. He may not have intended to kill Jamie, but felt great remorse about the situation, which is why the pillow was found behind her head, and he made an attempt to call for help after fleeing the scene. The case would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in January of 1997, and while the broadcast generated a number of calls from viewers, it failed to bring about a resolution. In 2011, pieces of Jamie's clothing were submitted to a forensic lab, but it's unclear if any new physical evidence could be obtained. After nearly 30 years, the anonymous 911 caller has never come forward or been identified, and the murder of Jamie Santos continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So I'm definitely unsettled by unsolved cold cases in which we have audio recordings of an anonymous caller who may hold the key to solving the mystery, yet years go by and they are never identified. And it's particularly unsettling if the caller might be the killer, which is certainly a distinct possibility in the Jamie Santos case. The audio of this 911 call was released publicly to the media in Illinois within days of Jamie's murder, and it would receive national exposure when it was played on Unsolved Mysteries just over 5 years later. Yet this man has never been identified, and I don't get the impression they have turned up any promising suspects. I do find it particularly interesting that investigators believe the caller had knowledge of the area because he knew Jamie's exact address and corrected the 911 operator when she thought it was Stonehenge Drive instead of Stonehedge. But even though Wheeling is a suburb of Chicago, it was not an area known for violent crime. To put things into perspective, in 1991, there were a total of 925 murders in Chicago, but Jamie's murder was the only one which took place in Wheeling, and there would not be another murder there until 1999. You have to think that if this man lived in the Wheeling area, someone would have recognized his voice and positively identified him, but whenever anyone came forward with an idea of who he might be, the leads never went anywhere. Now, it is interesting to go back and look at the original media coverage of this case, because in October of 1992, around the one-year anniversary of Jamie's murder, the Chicago Tribune published a couple of articles which stated that police had told the Santos family that they believed the person who dialed 911 was trying to help Jamie and was likely not her killer. However, in subsequent media coverage of the case, such as the Unsolved Mystery segment, law enforcement has been a lot more ambiguous about whether they believe this guy was the perpetrator or simply a concerned bystander. I would not be surprised if investigators might have attempted to downplay their suspicion a little bit in hopes that he might be inclined to come forward if he felt that law enforcement did not think he was involved in the murder. But if so, this strategy obviously did not work, and I get the sense that they're no closer to identifying him today than they were back in 1991. But let's look at both sides of the coin and explore the possibility that the caller was a truly innocent bystander who did nothing more than stumble upon Jamie's body. Why would he call 911 anonymously and travel half a block to a payphone? He told the operator that Jamie was not breathing and turning blue, but if he really was concerned about saving her life, why not use the phone at her townhouse instead of wasting potentially crucial time? After all, Jamie was technically still alive when the paramedics arrived, so could those few extra minutes have prevented them from saving her life? From listening to the audio of the call, I'm sure you noticed how abruptly this man said bye and hung up after the operator asked him, "When were you at that house, sir?" It's obvious he did not want to answer that question. The Unsolved Mysteries segment presented a reenactment of a potential scenario where the caller noticed that Jamie's front door was open and decided to walk inside to check what was going on, only to find her body on the floor. He may have decided to call 911 without giving his name, because he feared he would be blamed for the crime. Well, I guess if the caller had heard a struggle inside the house, or saw someone running away from the scene, he might have become suspicious enough to check it out. But really, how many bystanders are just going to walk past an open door at a resident and feel compelled to go inside without a logical reason? One theory I've seen pushed forward is that this caller attempted to perform a burglary, and by pure coincidence, he just happened to find Jamie's body after he broke in. He didn't want to just leave her there, but he also didn't want to stick around and explain to the cops why he broke into her townhouse, which is why he hightailed it out of there to the nearest payphone. Another interesting theory I've read online is that the guy could have been some sort of voyeur who was watching Jamie, and the situation was a bit reminiscent of the plot of the classic Alfred Hitchcock movie, Rear Window. In case you haven't seen the film, it involves James Stewart playing a character who passes the time by secretly spying on his neighbors at his apartment complex, but then he becomes convinced he has seen one of them commit a murder. But of course, the big dilemma for him is how do you report that to the police without outing yourself as a peeping Tom? So perhaps the caller had been spying on Jamie and saw her murder take place, and while he wanted to get her medical attention, he did not want to answer questions from the police and reveal why he was watching Jamie in the first place. However, when all is said and done, I am inclined to think that the caller was the killer. It's been nearly 30 years, and given the lack of progress in the investigation, I'd like to think the caller would have come forward and revealed everything he knew if he truly played no role in Jamie's death, because at the very least, he could finally be ruled out as a suspect. But of course, if the caller was responsible for what happened to Jamie, the big unanswered question is whether he truly wanted her to survive. Did he know that Jamie was technically still alive when he fled the scene? Calling 911 and getting his voice captured on tape was a big enough risk, but if the paramedics had managed to save Jamie's life, she could have identified her attacker, especially if it was an individual she knew personally. It's been theorized that the perpetrator never intended on killing Jamie, but took things too far and felt remorse about what they did. This would explain the gesture of placing the pillow behind her head after using it to suffocate her. Even if he believed Jamie was already dead, he may have wanted her body to be found, and the anonymous 911 call was about as close to a confession as he was willing to give. Of course, there were no signs of forced entry at the residence, and the front door was unlocked, so this suggests that Jamie willingly let her killer inside. It may have been someone she felt comfortable enough with that she did not feel they posed any threat to her safety, but they were not involved in any sort of intimate relationship. While it's possible that he attacked Jamie because she resisted his advances, he did not actually go through the act of sexually assaulting her. Since Jamie had canceled her bookings the previous night after supposedly becoming ill, I guess it's tempting to infer that this could have been a cover story because Jamie wanted to have a guest over at her residence who spent the night there. But given that sexual assault was ruled out, I'm assuming this also excludes the possibility of her having consensual sex with anyone prior to her death. Since Jamie was found wearing a nightshirt and it was common practice for her to sleep in until noon, this suggests that the killer woke Jamie up or arrived shortly after she woke up. According to those who knew her, Jamie decided to work as an exotic dancer because she made good money, but she was eventually hoping to settle down and start a family and just hadn't found the right guy yet. We know that she had been dating a couple of men, but they were not considered to be suspects, so if her killer was someone she was involved with, then her friends and family likely never knew about him. I know there was talk about Jamie potentially moving to California with the musician she had been dating, so if she was serious about taking that relationship to the next level, but was secretly seeing someone else on the side, perhaps she told this person she wanted to end things, and they did not take it well. It's tempting to believe that Jamie's killer might have been someone she crossed paths with while performing at private parties, but those who worked with her said she couldn't have been any more conscientious about keeping her work life separated from her private life. She performed under a stage name, never shared her real name or phone number with anyone she met at these parties, and made it a rule to never date anyone she met under these circumstances. In fact, one of Jamie's drivers said there was a party where she met a guy whom she thought was really cute, but she said she was not going to break her rules by exchanging personal information with him. It's certainly possible that Jamie's killer was someone she crossed paths with at one of these events who developed a fixation on her. Since it's unlikely she would have given him her address, he may have had the initiative to find out where he lived on his own. But of course, if someone like this suddenly showed up at Jamie's front door one morning, would she have led him into the house? Since Jamie made all of her bookings at private parties through various agencies, she had to give them a cut of her earnings, so an additional theory I've seen presented during online discussions about this case is that perhaps Jamie was performing freelance escort work on the side. However, given how careful she was about protecting her privacy, I'm not sure Jamie would have run the risk of inviting a potential client into her home. Another potential theory is that the killer was one of the drivers or bodyguards who accompanied her to the parties. Jamie would likely feel comfortable enough with one of these people to invite them inside her residence, and if one of them had developed an infatuation with her and she rejected him, things could have escalated into violence. However, I have to think that investigators would have checked into all of these drivers and bodyguards, and if any of them stood out as potential suspects, they never said so. Overall, I do think there are signs that point to the killer being someone Jamie knew, but not someone that other people in her personal life knew about, which is why they've never been able to figure out who he was. While I guess we can't 100% rule out the possibility that the caller was not the person who killed Jamie, I am inclined to think he was. He may have felt remorse about what he did, but was not guilt-ridden enough that he would willingly turn himself in and face consequences for his actions. But one of the reasons this case should never be considered unsolvable is that we have actual audio of the potential killer's voice. It can be found all over the internet, as it's not only featured in the Unsolved Mystery segment, but there's also an individual YouTube clip containing the full uncut audio of the call. So even though 3 decades have passed, there's always a chance that the right person might wind up hearing it and recognize the caller's voice, giving this case the proper break it needs. If you think you might know who the caller is, or have any other information about the murder of Jamie Santos, please contact the Wheeling Police Department at 847-459-2632. That's 847-459-2632. So now let's move on to our next case. But before we continue, we would like to send out a special thanks to Manly Bands for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Manly Bands helps men find wedding bands that fit their personality and their budget with unique and stylish designs. If you want to get your personalized Manly Band, here's how the process works. You first get their Manly ring sizer to ensure that it will fit you perfectly, and once you know your size, then you get to choose from their wide selection of materials which include gold, wood, antler, steel, and even dinosaur bone. You can also choose from one of Manly Band's curated collections, such as, for example, the Jack Daniel's Whiskey Barrel Collection. Once you've selected your band, you get free shipping worldwide, a 30-day exchange policy, and a free warranty. Now, a few weeks ago, I shared a story about how our podcast's very own editor-slash-producer, McGill, decided to order a black zirconium from Manly Bands known as the Fitzgerald because when he originally got married to his wife, they could not afford wedding rings for each other. The Fitzgerald appealed to McGill because of its 14K rose gold plating on the sides, and I'm happy to say that he has since received it and is wearing it with pride. It is very comfortable and stylish, and McGill also thought that the customer service at Manly Bands was fantastic since he personally spoke to someone who did a great job at ensuring he got the right size. But even if you already have your own wedding band, it's still a fun idea to purchase from Manly Bands since you can get yourself an additional band which perfectly suits your personality. So to get 21% off your Manly Band for a limited time, go to manlybands.com/cold. Plus, you'll get a free silicone ring. That's manlybands.com/cold for 21% off for a limited time. We would also like to send out a special thanks to Ready Slim, a wellness company that focuses on providing the highest quality detox and keto products for any busy lifestyle. When you're constantly working on a podcast, you're going to be spending a lot more time sitting than doing physical activity, which is why it helps to have a good beverage like Ready Slim. I do love to drink tea while I'm writing and researching, and Ready Slim's detox teas are made with high-quality, 100% organic herbs and have no fillers, no additives, and no laxatives. They're safe to drink daily, so they can gently boost your metabolism and help with digestion while also reducing bloating. Ready Slim's 28-day detox tea kit has everything you need, and there are two options. The Wakey Wakey Morning Detox Tea, which helps boost your energy levels to start your day off, and the Snoozy Night Detox Tea, which helps you relax and supports the natural detox process while you get your well-deserved beauty sleep. If I feel like I need a boost of energy, I help myself to the Wakey Wakey Morning Detox Tea, but if I'm working at night and feel that I can't unwind and get to sleep afterward, the Snoozy Night Detox Tea is the best option, and I do appreciate that Ready Slim offers them both. In addition, Ready Slim also helps aid in weight loss and is keto-friendly, so to save 25% on your first order of Ready Slim's 28-day detox tea kit for a limited time, go to readyslim.com/cold. You'll also get a free collapsible water bottle. That's readyslim.com/cold to save 25% on your first purchase of Ready Slim's 28-day detox tea kit plus a free collapsible water bottle. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. Our second story begins in Florida in 1991, and our victim is a 26-year-old African-American woman named Rebecca Young. Sadly, when Rebecca was only 12 years old, her own mother was murdered, so both she and her brother went to live with their aunt in the town of Pahokee. Rebecca eventually moved to the nearby town of Belleglade, which was located in Palm Beach County and had a population of around 16,000 at that time. Belleglade is often referred to as Muck City, since the surrounding area contains a large amount of waterlogged sapric soil known as muck, which is used to grow sugarcane, and, appropriately enough, the crime in this episode took place next to a sugarcane field. On May the 1st, a 911 dispatcher in Miami received a phone call from a man who was speaking very quickly in Spanish. Since the dispatcher could not understand him, the caller was transferred to a detective from the Miami Police Department. The caller said his name was Antonio, and reported that 1 week earlier, he had been hunting rabbit in a sugarcane field located outside Belleglade. Antonio claimed he heard the sound of a vehicle approaching on an empty stretch of land located between the field and the tree line of a wooded area, and since he was hunting illegally, he decided to hide out in the sugarcane. From his vantage point, Antonio saw a blue Ford Bronco come to a stop before a black woman and a man whom Antonio believed was Mexican climb out. The man and woman broke out into an argument as he demanded that she give him some money, but she said she did not have it. While this was going on, a second man whom Antonio described as looking Cuban climbed out of the Bronco. Things escalated to the point where the Mexican man shoved the woman to the ground, prompting her to shout, quote, "Ricardito, don't kill me, Ricardito." He responded by pulling a machete out of the Bronco and repeatedly striking the woman with it until she was dead. The killer's accomplice then helped him drag the woman's body into some tall grass next to the tree line before they climbed back into the Bronco and drove away. Antonio said he got a quick look at the license plate and was able to make out the numbers 7 and 2. The crime left Antonio so terrified that he waited an entire week before he called 911 and said he was doing so from a payphone because he did not have a phone at home. Antonio also said that the sugarcane field was located behind a building shaped like an ice cream cone, but he ended the call before police could get any more personal information from him, and they never heard from him again. Even though he spoke entirely in Spanish, here is a portion of the original audio from Antonio's 911 call.
La muchacha y él, entonces él le parece que es un problema de droga, ¿no? Entonces donde él le decía que le entregara
The English translation for what he says here is, quote, "I'm hunting rabbit when I saw a blue Bronco arrive with license plate number 72, and then they started to argue, the girl and him. It appeared to be a drug problem. He was telling her to give him the money," end quote. Since the crime Antonio describes supposedly took place near Belgrade, the case was assigned to Detective Frank Mayo of the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office, who went searching for the location on the very same day the call took place. Mayo believed that the building Antonio described, which was shaped like an ice cream cone, might have been a local ice cream stand called the Twisty Treat. When Mayo went to the establishment, he noticed that there was a wooded area located about a mile south of it on State Road 827. Mayo drove there and noticed an empty stretch of land between the tree line and a sugarcane field, and after traveling down that route, he eventually noticed something in an area of tall grass. It turned out to be the body of a woman who had passed the stage of decomposition and was now entering the mummification stage, so at this point, Mayo could not even determine her race. An autopsy would determine that the victim died of multiple incised wounds, which seemed to support Antonio's story that she was attacked with a machete. Aside from her right thumb, most of her fingers had become skeletonized, but her remaining thumbprint was used to positively identify her as Rebecca Young. The last confirmed sighting of Rebecca while she was alive had taken place on April the 24th, when she was seen leaving her apartment and climbing into a car. At the time, Rebecca was involved with a man who had reportedly threatened and intimidated her into entering a lifestyle of drugs and sex work and had beaten her up on more than one occasion. Investigators looked into this man's background, and while they concluded that he was not a suspect in Rebecca's murder, he had an extensive history of theft, leading to speculation that he might have stolen from the wrong person who subsequently sought violent retribution and attacked Rebecca. The Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office soon received a report about a local resident who had allegedly bragged to a sex worker that he had killed a black woman. On May the 14th, just under 2 weeks after the discovery of Rebecca's body, this man was pulled over by the police, and when he emerged from his vehicle, he appeared to be drunk or stoned and started behaving erratically before he was taken into custody. When Detective Mayo went to interrogate him, the first thing the man said was that Mayo wanted to talk to him about a murder, even though no one from the police had even mentioned a murder yet. When Mayo told him that he only wanted to talk about the sex worker he had recently been with, the man said he was no longer going to say anything and asked for an attorney. Since there was no other evidence that he was complicit in Rebecca's murder, the police had no choice but to release him, though they still suspected his involvement. Investigators now focused all their attention on tracking down the mysterious Antonio, who was supposedly a direct eyewitness to the crime. They had no luck determining his identity, though on the basis of the audio from his 911 call, they believed he had a Cuban accent and might have been an immigrant. The case would garner national exposure when it was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, which aired in November of 1992. A public plea was sent out for Antonio to come forward, and the authorities stated that he was not wanted for any crime. However, since Antonio was never heard from again, the investigation hit a brick wall. So after 30 years, Rebecca Young's murder is still an unsolved cold case. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So this is a pretty brutal and sadistic crime, and sadly, other than the Unsolved Mystery segment, and a few news articles that were published in the Palm Beach Post and the South Florida Sun Sentinel at that time, there isn't much information available about the case at all, and it doesn't sound like there has been any movement in 3 decades. I would really like to learn more about the background of Rebecca Young, as her own mother was murdered around 14 years before she was, but sadly, I couldn't find any additional details about that crime. I know that Rebecca's aunt, Lucille Williams, who wound up raising her, described Rebecca as a quiet, shy girl who would do anything for anybody, and it sounds like they had a pretty close relationship. Unfortunately, it sounds like Rebecca eventually got herself involved with a guy who dragged her into the world of drugs and sex work. His name has never been released publicly, and there's no information out there about him, other than the fact that he was abusive towards Rebecca and had a history of petty crime. While investigators did not believe he was responsible for Rebecca's murder, it's possible that he may have indirectly paved the way for it by angering the wrong person. From watching the Unsolved Mystery segment, you got the impression that investigators had their own idea about who was responsible for this crime, but desperately needed the 911 caller, Antonio, to come forward and share his version of events on the record before they made an arrest. Now, unlike the Jamie Santos case, law enforcement has never given off any indication that they believe Antonio was involved in the crime and heavily emphasized that point on Unsolved Mysteries. Of course, if they did have their suspicions about Antonio, perhaps they did not say so publicly in order to not scare him off from coming forward. But even if Antonio was completely innocent, there are a number of other reasons why he might not have wanted to deal with the authorities. By his own admission, Antonio was hunting illegally in that sugarcane field at the time the murder took place, and I'm sure that witnessing a woman get butchered with a machete would be a traumatic enough experience to scare someone into remaining silent. However, I think the most logical explanation for Antonio not wanting to speak to the police would be if there were issues with his immigration status. He did not speak any English, and judging from his accent, investigators believe he may have been born in Cuba, and it's apparently not uncommon for Cuban immigrants to be found working in sugarcane fields in Palm Beach County, and some of them are undocumented. So if Antonio was not in the United States legally, he may have feared deportation if he spoke directly to the authorities about the murder. It's also worth noting that even though Unsolved Mysteries simply referred to the caller as Antonio, one article in the South Florida Sun Sentinel said that he identified himself as Antonio Fonseca, but assuming that wasn't a pseudonym, I'm guessing investigators never had any luck turning up anyone by that name. While none of the sources have specifically stated where Antonio's call originated from, it was received by a 911 dispatcher in Miami, even though the city is over 80 miles southeast of Belgrade. So this would seem to indicate that the call originated from Miami, and since Antonio was unable to provide specific directions to the location of Rebecca's body, and only said that it was located behind a building with a giant ice cream cone, I wonder if that meant he wasn't from Palm Beach County. Now, Antonio said that he called 911 from a payphone because he didn't have a phone at home. So if he was living in poverty, I have to wonder if perhaps he did not even own a TV set as well. Even though Antonio's voice would eventually be heard by millions of people when it was broadcast on Unsolved Mysteries, who knows if he found out about it. If he was an immigrant, Antonio may have left the US and returned to his native country at some point these past 30 years, and may be completely unaware that the crime he witnessed was once featured on national television. But the other alternate possibility I wanted to address is whether or not Antonio could have fabricated the entire story. Yes, we know that Rebecca's murder took place at that location since her body was found there, but what if Antonio was not the innocent bystander he claimed to be and was personally involved in the crime? If he felt remorse or guilt about the whole thing, he may have decided to lead the authorities to Rebecca's body by calling 911 and feeding them a false story about being an eyewitness. According to Antonio's account, the actual killer was a Mexican man whom Rebecca referred to as Ricardito, and he had an accomplice with him who appeared to be Cuban. Now, we know that a potential suspect was brought in for questioning a few weeks later after he allegedly bragged about killing a black woman, but what complicates things is that investigators have withheld his identity and not released any details about him to the public. So it's tough to know how well this guy fits in with Antonio's version of events. I know we should not take reenactments from Unsolved Mysteries as gospel for accuracy, but their segment features a scene with this guy being pulled over by the police, and he appears to be a long-haired white man driving a beat-up-looking red car. Was this guy's name Ricardito, or was he associated with anyone by that name? Did he have any Mexican or Cuban associates who matched the description of the second man Antonio saw at the murder scene? Antonio said that they arrived in a blue Ford Bronco. So did the suspect own or have access to a vehicle like that at the time? And if so, did the license plate have the number 7 and 2, like Antonio described? Before she was murdered, Rebecca had apparently last been seen leaving her apartment in a car, so how did she wind up in this Ford Bronco? Did the suspect have any personal connection to Rebecca or her boyfriend, or any discernible motive to harm her? The killer supposedly kept demanding that Rebecca give her some money before he killed her, so did she or her boyfriend owe this guy any money at that time? During his call, Antonio also said he thought the argument was over a drug problem, but was there anything specific which made him believe that? On the basis of their interviews during the Unsolved Mystery segment, It seems obvious that investigators believe this suspect was involved, but since two people were alleged to be complicit in this crime, it's unclear if they had any promising leads about who his accomplice might have been. We technically only have Antonio's word that Rebecca's murder unfolded the way he said it did, but if the authorities ever had any credibility issues with his story and suspected that he might have been complicit or lying, they never said so publicly. All that being said, the only way we could ever know for certain is if Antonio came forward and shared his side of the story. You get the impression that investigators were only one step away from making an arrest, but they needed Antonio's eyewitness testimony in order to have the necessary evidence to bring any suspects to trial. After all this time, it might be difficult to track Antonio down, but it's also possible that there might be others out there who have information about this case and could bring about a resolution. So if you happen to know anything about the murder of Rebecca Young, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about the bizarre 1934 ransom kidnapping of June Robles, who was found alive inside a metal box in the desert, but her kidnappers were never caught, and there's been some debate about whether the whole thing might have been an elaborate hoax. I'm also going to be dropping the occasional exclusive bonus Patreon episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, and we recently released an episode in which myself and my co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the unsolved disappearance of convenience store clerk Deborah Poe. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Shelley, K. Moss, Brian M., Sarabarab, Java C., Alyssa P., Rachel, Robert S., Michael F., and Mandy O. Thank you all so much for your support. I'm also pleased to announce that The Trail Went Cold has been added to the lineup for Podcast Row at CrimeCon 2022, which is being held in Las Vegas from April the 29th until May the 1st. If you would like to purchase tickets, we already have our own personalized promo code to get a discount. So to receive a 10% discount off a standard badge, please visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. That's crimecon.com, and the promo code is TRAIL. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.